Accession number 32719, Reel 3.
And I don't know anything more about it. We did not have rockets in our group, and that was debatable. Because the accuracy of the rockets in World War II was about as accurate as a golfer driving a golf ball off the green. You don't know if it's going to hook or slice, and that made some of the pilots flying alongside a little nervous. So that's the main reason we didn't have them. Next slide. Okay, there it is. The hood is off. The covers are off. The engine is very easy to service. Next slide. And there's another one. The cover's off. Next slide. Okay, that's the front of it. That's where the air intake is. It brings air all the way back to the supercharger. And there's compression sent to the engine. Next slide. Okay, there's another airplane with the cowl off. I don't see anything unusual on it. Next. Okay. Those of you, and a lot of you are old enough to remember, seeing the black and white newsreels of the F-6F, I think it is, or F-4F, landing on a carrier and then that engine getting ripped off. Remember that? That'll never happen in a Thunderbolt because that's the engine mounts, and that engine can never be torn up. The Thunderbolt was twice the weight of the other fighters, empty, 14,000 pounds. And if we carried 500-pound bombs, 108-gallon belly tank, and all 3,200 rounds of ammunition, we grossed out about 18,000. The Mustang fully loaded was much less than that, probably around 11 or 12,000. And the Spitfire was 5,700-pound empty and didn't carry much of a load, only 12 seconds of ammunition. Next slide. Okay, here is a slide that I included to show the trim tab in the elevator, trim tab on the rudder, and look at the size of those flaps. Again, the Spitfire and the ME-109 were 1930 airplanes, and they didn't have the flaps anywhere that size, and they didn't have the trim tabs. So this is a full caster tail wheel. So while S-ing and turning, the brakes have to be used. The tail wheel needs to be locked prior to takeoff, and that was in the pilot's checklist. Next slide. Bob, you're the one that wanted this slide in. That's the R2800 engine, 18-cylinder, two rows of nine. And because of the size of it, is this upside down?
Yeah, it's upside down, Mike.
Okay. Well, then next slide then. Okay, this is what it looked like at an English base or a French base. The friendly mud, the pilot in his flying suit, and one of the tractors that had a track on it to whatever it does, plow the mud or repair the field. Next slide.
That's it.
That's it. Okay, let's have some lights. I've got a few notes here. We have some lights. Okay. I've gone through a lot of the books I have to take some figures that I think are important.
A young person once asked me, "Well,
what can you tell me about World War II?" Well, I said, in one sentence, we won. Well, why did we win? We won
because we did most everything right. I went through figures I found in some of the books. The organization of the air forces was much better than our adversary or any other.
In World War II, there are 21 numbered air
forces, and each one had a different mission. The first four were training air forces in the U.S. And all of you have heard of the 8th Air Force in England and the 9th Air Force in Europe, the 12th and 15th in Italy. The 8th Air Force at peak strength is
320,000 personnel. It could put up 1,000 four-engine bombers, and that meant it had to possess 2,000 for backups and spares. It could also put up 1,000 escort fighters. It had a clearly defined strategic mission: destroy the enemy's resources that would impact the battlefield, oil supply, and all that. The 9th Air Force was a tactical air force, and that meant it had two-engine bombers and fighter bombers. The 9th, it was only about 220,000 personnel, but it had 1,450 Thunderbolts in the 18 groups that it had, and was organized as a battlefield air force to operate below 6,000 feet in a ground attack role. In 1943, while they were thinking about the invasion of Europe, it looked like the Air Corps would need to use the SBD for dive bombing in Europe. However, dropping and carrying bombs from a fighter aircraft had already been done with the P-40 in the Far East, and the P-40 and Hurricane in Africa. So one of the groups, the 350th, I found out by reading, tested the P-47 and found that it was an ideal airplane for carrying bombs. It had the strength, and it had the power, and if it had a long enough runway, it could do so. And also, it had the firepower as a ground attack airplane. The Germans did not have a good, decent ground attack airplane. The Stuka was merely dive bombing. The Navy stuck to dive bombers. Well, of course, they are fighting a different war in the Pacific. But when the 850 caliber guns of the P-47 and the striking power they had was recognized, then it became the ideal fighter bomber, and that was a new term coined. By the way,
we call the Mustang the
flying spam can because of its light design, and they call us the flying bucket of bolts in there. And we often say, if you're going to an air show, bring a Mustang. If you're going to war, bring a Thunderbolt. However, after exchanging these pleasantries, I remember flying over in France there at 6,000 feet, looking at ground targets and facing flat, and looking at these Mustangs pulling their vapor trails at 30,000 feet. You know, we wish we were up there. Anyway, the missions that we ran out of France, and Harold is filming this, and he expects me to tell it because it's already gotten out into the public anyway, can't hear my, hurt my reputation anymore. But I had never fired all 8 guns till I got assigned to the 509 Squadron of the 405th Group in France. And it was an experience, all of them 8 at the same time, but it's something you got used to. We did mostly dive bombing, carrying a 500-pound bomb underneath your wing, and we attacked marshaling yards, which drew quite a bit of flak. Well, let's see. A fighter group is authorized 25 pilots in each of the 3 squadrons. That's 75, plus 5 at group headquarters, 80. Okay, so in 13 months of combat, we lost 97 pilots. A fighter squadron would go through the entire pilot roster in about 9 or 10 months. That's why replacements are necessary, and I was one of the replacements. Anyway, I had dropped bombs a couple of times, and an unusual mission came along to attack and destroy a bridge that the Army wanted out. It was only about 40 miles inside the other side of the lines. And it was across a river that was about 1.5 football fields wide, and they selected just 4 ships. That's the only 4 ship mission that I was on. Most of the others, all of the others, were either 12 or 16. And I was the least experienced, tail end Charlie, and we knew the exact coordinates of the bridge. Now, the way the bombs were dropped, compared to other aircraft, the Stuka started out at about 20,000 feet, dove at 70-degree angle with a bomb sight, released at 11,000 or some variation of that. The SBD started at 11,000 and with the speed brakes out, hung in the air and dropped at 6,000. We started at 6,000, rolled over on our back, then pulled straight down and got the target right in the gun sight, released, and then pulled hard, about a 6 or 7 G pull out. It happened quickly. Later on, when I became a physics teacher, I went through all the calculations. 6,000 feet above the ground, when we rolled over, with an average descent of 660 feet a minute, we were 9.2 seconds from the ground. And at 1,500 feet, when we released the bomb and pulled out, we were 1.2 seconds from the ground. So that had to be a hard pull out. Anyway, we circled and we looked at this bridge, and no flak, so we were in trail. And the leader went down, dropped two big geysers in the river. He missed it. Number two went down, two big red explosions on the approach of the bridge, so the bridge is still standing. Number three went down, dropped in two big geysers in the river, so he missed the bridge. Then I thought, gee, it's up to me to save the mission. I'd better really get on it. So I thought I made a good lineup, because between the fuselage and the number one gun, oh, it's a couple of feet, and that on the left side, if we pulled up, looking over the left, about in halfway in between, when the target crossed the leading edge wing, just pull the nose up, roll over on the back, straight down, find the target in the optical sight, line up on it, release the bombs, and pull up. Well, what I did, concentrating, you know, like an inexperienced pilot, and I rolled over and looked down, and I got to make it good. Ooh, it's time to pull up. So I forgot to release the bombs. Off they go, and they get flung out way, way, way out. And so I racked it up on the wing, and my eyesight was very good at that time. They kept going and going and going. And they hit in the woods about a mile and a quarter from the bridge. Really missed it. I called the flight leader and said, did you look over in that direction?
I bombs went off.
Yeah.
Well, what happened? Two big red flashes where the bombs went off. And then several other flashes. The white smoke, a few more flashes. And I asked the flight leader, did he see that? Yes, he did. And when we landed, I reported to the intelligence officer during the briefing,
and he said, well, we know the exact coordinates because we know the bridge.
We know the woods, and looking at the map, we'll call them to 19th Pack and have them send over 3rd Army. Well, a few weeks later, the intelligence officer said, we found out what that was, the woods. That was a B-1 launch site. It was camouflaged. And so now you know my only contribution to World War II. But anyway, I thought, gee, those poor Germans in the woods, they're wondering, how the hell do they know we're here? Anyway, another thing that we did was cut rail, and this is important. If we had no bombing target, say, 4 airplanes out of flight, that A-bomb one, would fly at 5,000 feet over the railroad tracks, and about every mile or mile and a half kicked out a bomb. 500-pound bomb made a crater about the size to put a 6x truck in, and we did that manually with the release handle, and then another one. So if we made 8 cuts on the rail track between two towns, we knew there were work gangs in each of the towns to fill the rail cuts, and it would take them 24 hours for each cut. So they start from one town, 24 hours first cut, and then go to the next one. So that rail line would be incapacitated for 2 or 3 days. Our group made about 790 rail cuts. 9th Air Force made 14,000
total.
We're about out of time, aren't we?
Yep.
Huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Then I was going to say on
fighter speeds, the Hurricane T-40 were about 335, the Spitfire, Mustang, and ME-109 were about 365, and the Thunderbolt was about 335 at low altitude. But about 25,000 feet, the Thunderbolt was
an honest 426-mile-an-hour airplane. And that's where it gets in. Now,
it was the first fighter bomber. The accuracy, we said, was better than the bombers, but then again, they discount a couple of my missions. However, the concept of fighter bomber is something that has not only remained but improved on, because all fighters after World War II are also attack aircraft, aren't they? F-18, F-14, F-15, F-16. So, by comparison here, what they have done and with the modern munitions is employing the fighter aircraft to also carry munitions to drop them, which we did visually in World War II. If there are any questions, why don't you just ask me afterwards? One thing about Thunderbolt pilots, they like to talk more about the airplane than themselves, because the airplane is what really had the impact on the war. Thank you for your time, and thank you, Ted.
Such detail, by golly.
We're caught here. Ah, here we go. That's the solution. No.
I think my hearing aid is just calm
down. Oh, my God. Can you hear me? Because I do want to thank you. A heartfelt thanks for all your detailing. We've never had it before. And from the group, a token of appreciation for your wonderful talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next newsletter will have details on our picnic with Crossing Cockade. Thank you for coming out. So nice to see all of you. Been a long time. See you later.
Bye.
Remember now, driving to the airport is the most dangerous part of flying. Be careful.